From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Donald Trump confirmed this morning that ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson is his pick for Secretary of State. But opposition to Tillerson's nomination is already mounting, with critics saying he's too close to Vladimir Putin and that Tillerson has no government experience. Former Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine tweeted, "Tillerson for Secretary of State? What's next? Climate change deniers for EPA and energy? Oh, wait." Joining us now is someone who thinks Tillerson could be successful, Suzanne Maloney, deputy director of the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution and a former Middle East advisor at ExxonMobil. Suzanne, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much.
And you say that some of the criticism of Rex Tillerson is unfair. Why?
Well, I think what people are judging are his position, his longstanding role at ExxonMobil, as well as making presumptions about his relationship with Vladimir Putin based on his business activities in Russia. I think that there's a bit of a knee-jerk reaction and almost instinctive opposition to someone who comes from a corporate background on the presumption that that sort of person really doesn't know anything about foreign policy. My experience says otherwise.
Well, and tell us more about your experience with Rex Tillerson or with ExxonMobil that leads you to believe he'd be a good candidate.
Well, I worked at ExxonMobil with an enormous number of smart people, people who had long experience in the region in which they worked. They understood quite a bit about regional dynamics, about internal dynamics of the countries in which they did business, and they had, I think, a very important lens on U.S. policy toward different parts of the world. As a result of that experience, I think, in a sense, we shouldn't rule out the ability of corporate types to understand the world around them. Their business depends on a deep and nuanced appreciation of the political context in which they do business. I look at Mr. Tillerson's experience in Russia as one that can be quite valuable. He knows how difficult the environment is there. He managed to both secure deals and steward projects over a long period of time in an environment that isn't typically very hospitable to American entities.
Well, let's listen to some of the criticism about Tillerson and his ties to Vladimir Putin. This is John McCain, Arizona Senator John McCain, Republican, speaking on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday.
He has such a close personal relationship with Vladimir Putin, and obviously they've done enormous deals together, that would color his approach to Vladimir Putin and the Russian threat.
And Tillerson did, in fact, get a medal from President Putin. So that doesn't concern you at all, given the dynamics between the U.S. and Russia right now?
I think Mr. Tillerson obviously ought to be asked about all of the details of his personal relationship with Vladimir Putin in any confirmation hearings. However, I think the presumption that simply because there was personal contact between them that they're somehow best friends is a little bit quick to judgment. In effect, you know, doing business in a country doesn't mean a close personal relationship. It requires some mutual respect, but it does not entail a compromise of principles. And my experience with ExxonMobil, as well as my, you know, sort of vantage point here in Washington, both at the State Department as well as my time here at Brookings, leaves me to believe that there is, in fact, a capacity to interact with other countries in a way that involves, an enormous retention of the principles by which one lives without necessarily violating them.
You brought up the fact that Tillerson comes from corporate America and that there's nothing inherently wrong with putting somebody from corporate America at the State Department. But do you think that there is something specifically upsetting to people about the head of an oil company?
I have no doubt that ExxonMobil in particular and the oil industry in general tends to generate very strong views, and I understand those views. I think, again, these are issues that should be dealt with in any confirmation process. But I don't think that simply because someone comes from a background in energy, that means that they're somehow invalidated from having any capacity to make fair and reasonable judgments on foreign policy issues. In fact, I think to do business in a company as diversified and complex with operations as spread out around the world as a company like ExxonMobil, you really do have to understand the realities of the world in which you live. And on that basis, I think that Tillerson could be a very good choice for Secretary of State.
Do you think that he can win confirmation? Because we've already seen a number of senators raise some questions, especially about his ties to Putin.
I think that he's certainly going to have a tough hearing. There's no question that there are concerns about both his energy background, his ties to Putin. I think that there is an overall suspicion toward someone who has not had direct government experience in the past. But I don't think that any of these criteria should be used to invalidate Mr. Tillerson's nomination. I think, in fact, that there is some real utility to having someone who comes from a managerial background, someone who has seen the world through a different lens, and can, in fact, contribute to American foreign policy in that way.
That's Suzanne Maloney, Deputy Director of the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and a former Middle East advisor at ExxonMobil, talking with us about Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. Suzanne Maloney, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
4 years ago, Rex Tillerson's nomination would have needed 60 votes in the Senate to be approved. Now, he only needs 51. That's thanks to a Senate rule change pushed through by Democrats in 2013, which at the time had Republicans up in arms. Here's Republican Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor.
If you want to play games, set yet another precedent that you'll no doubt come to regret. Say to my friends on the other side of the aisle, you'll regret this. And you may regret it a lot sooner than you think.
Well, many of them do. At that time, Democrats had control of the Senate and the presidency. Things have changed. NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis is here. Hi, Susan.
Hey, Robin.
So set the scene for us, because you were there covering Congress. Republicans, as we heard, saw this rule change as self-serving. Why were Democrats arguing for it at the time?
You know, this was the result of probably a decades-long debate in the Senate over whether this rule needed to be changed. And the breaking point in 2013 for Democrats, who were in the majority at the time, was Republicans' decision to block three of President Obama's nominees to the D.C. Court of Appeals. There was three vacancies on that court. It's one of the nation's most powerful courts right below the Supreme Court, and it has oversight over federal agencies and regulations, and it's very powerful. And it had a Republican tilt at the time, and three President Obama vacancies would change that. So Republicans had held up the nominations, and Democrats said that that was a step too far. So they changed the rules of the Senate so that all nominations before the Senate, all executive branch nominations, go from a 60-vote threshold to a 51-vote threshold, except for Supreme Court nominees. That is the only nomination that goes before the Senate in today's world that could still be subject to a filibuster of a 60-vote threshold.
Well, and here's how the Democrats were speaking at that time. Here's a clip of outgoing Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid on the Senate floor.
The Senate is a living thing, and to survive it must change, as it has over the history of this great country. To the average American, adapting the rules to make the Senate work again is just common sense.
So the Democrats felt that the Republicans were unfairly holding up presidential nominations. We heard Mitch McConnell say in that earlier clip that Democrats would come to regret this change. John McCain at the time talked about how this was a rule change pushed through by Democrats who hadn't yet experienced what it was like to be in the minority. Is that the case? Are you hearing regret now from Senate Democrats?
No, and if they regret it, they're only doing it in private. Publicly, Democrats say they made the right decision. In an outgoing editorial, Harry Reid, who pushed through the rules change, he's retiring this year, he wrote an impassioned defense of the rules change, and he said he was leaving behind a fairer and more open and productive Senate. He said what was fair for President Obama should be fair for President Trump, and that the view of Democrats is that at the time, and they still embrace it, that presidents have a certain amount of leeway to be able to fill their nominations and their cabinet posts with the people they choose, and that filibustering all of those nominations just led towards a culture of obstruction and weakening of the executive branch.
Well, let's look ahead at what might be happening now. Here's a clip of Senator Tim Kaine, the Democrat, of course, talking today about Rex Tillerson, the Exxon CEO nominated to be Secretary of State. Kaine citing reports that showed the company covered up its knowledge of global warming for years. Now, there's a court case here in Massachusetts centered around this. Let's listen to Kaine today.
The individual and the company, ExxonMobil, has a significant history in what I believe in funding climate denial, climate science denial, even though ExxonMobil has scientists and have been aware of climate science for a very long time. They've been part of an effort to muddy up the water and suggest to people that we don't need to worry about this as a problem. I'm very troubled about that.
Indicating there are going to be challenges to at least one nominee and probably many more. What do you think this confirmation process is going to be like?
Well, Rex Tillerson will go before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, of which Tim Kaine is a member. Oh, interestingly enough, another one of those members on the committee is Marco Rubio, a Republican from Florida, who has tweeted that he has some skepticism about Tillerson. He is expected to have a very rigorous confirmation hearing, certainly over his connections to Russia and the relationship there, considering the other news of the week about Russian hacking. But at this point, you know, there's been on the whole a fairly receptive, open view towards Trump's nominees in the Senate. And it is more likely than not that the overwhelming all of his nominees will get confirmed, barring something coming to light that is not known or something that really would offend Republican senators, because there are 52 of them, I believe, now that we've just had the Louisiana Senate race settled, and they have a lot of leeway there.
Right, because of the rules change. NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
Hopefully during the holidays, you'll be able to do some of this. Laughing is something we do every day if we're lucky. But do you know why we do it? Well, joining us now via Skype is Robert Provine, a neuroscientist and professor of psychology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. His most recent book is Curious Behavior, Yawning, Laughing, Hiccuping, and Beyond. And Robert, why does laughter belong in that group of things we do involuntarily?
Okay. Laughter is one of a series of inborn human behaviors, along with things like coughing and sneezing and yawning, belching, farting, the list goes on and on. And laughter, we do it all the time, but it's a topic full of surprises because a lot of things that everyone thinks they know about laughter are not true.
Like what?
Now, for example, we say we laugh for this reason or that reason, and yet laughter's not under conscious control. We have the same kind of difficulty laughing on command that we have crying on command. When we explain why we laugh, we're assuming this voluntary control, and it's not there. Another surprise is that laughter is presumed to be somehow related to humor, and yet only 10-15% of comments preceding laughter or anything that's remotely joke-like.
Wow, that's interesting. I would have thought that what you know you hear beforehand is what leads you to laugh. So what causes you to laugh then?
The source of laughter are other people, not jokes. Now, for example, most laughter follows comments like, "Hey, where have you been?" It's not someone telling a joke. This is a conclusion that's easy to test. Next time you're around friends and there's a lot of laughter, people are not telling each other jokes at a furious rate. They're just laughing. Also, the presumption that laughter is the decision to speak ha-ha can be easily disproven by asking someone to laugh. For example, I'll ask you right now, will you laugh for us?
I can fake it for you if you want.
Okay, fake it. Well,
no, not believable.
Game try, but not compelling. Now, can you cry now?
No, I can't do that.
Okay, laughing and crying, yawning, and some of these other behaviors are things that we do all the time, but they're not under conscious control. They simply happen. So while humor is not usually the result of jokes, it is the result of engaging in playful activity around other people. Laughter occurs 30 times more often in social and solitary situations. In other words, if you want more laughter in your life, simply find people who you like and spend time with them.
Why do we laugh when we're tickled?
Well, that's a very deep and broad issue, even though probably not a lot of our laughter, as adults at least, is associated with tickle. When's the last time you were tickled?
No, it's been a while.
It's been a while. Okay, well, that's too bad, because tickle and associated laughter is also an important part of sex play. Another topic for another time.
I guess so. And okay. This is a real laugh, by the way. I'm not faking
it. Laughter is literally the sound of labored breathing of rough and tumble play. So when someone is tickled and laughs, we're getting a very deep insight to where laughter came from. Especially if you don't tickle another person, you tickle the chimpanzee. If you tickle a chimpanzee, it makes its own special kind of laughter. In fact, I can imitate it for you. Okay. Sounds like panting. If you play that sound of real laughing chimpanzees to a naive audience, hardly anyone says it's laughter. They'll say it sounds like panting, maybe of a dog. Okay, well, the pant-pant sounds of chimpanzees has evolved into the ha-ha sound of modern humans. And this important transition gives clues about where human-type laughter came from. Laughter is literally the sound of labored breathing of rough-and-tumble play. So the panting sound of chimpanzees is the sound of their labored breathing. It's a sound that one playful chimpanzee sends to another, saying that I'm playing with you, I'm not attacking you.
And by the way, we got into this by talking about tickling. You can't tickle yourself, right? It's not possible.
Yeah. In fact, that's an important issue, because tickle not only gives us some insights to where laughter came from, it's the primal stimulus for laughter, but tickle also gives us important insights into other things. For example, the key is that you can't tickle yourself. In fact, we would be in big trouble if we were tickling ourselves. Every time we would touch ourselves or brush against a limb or going through a doorway would be startling and would be going through life in a giant chain reaction of goosey behavior. Not very appropriate. Our nervous system program is programmed to process out self-stimulation. So it takes another person to tickle us. And therein, not only tells us something important about tickle, but tells us something important about the very important philosophical and psychological issues of self and other. How many philosophers would have guessed it?
Is laughter contagious?
Yeah, laughter is very contagious. And that's one of the reasons why we have canned laughter, laugh tracks, and television situation comedies. We laugh simply when we hear other people laugh, just as we yawn when we hear or see other people yawn, or even talking about it as we're doing right now. So when we're looking at these contagious behaviors, we're dealing with a neurologically programmed social act.
There is a saying that a lot of people know that laughter is the best medicine. And I wonder, are there any actual health benefits to laughter?
That's a difficult question. Laughter is a behavior that evolved to change the behavior of other people. And to the extent that laughter is correlated with, for example, good health, maybe simply healthy people play more or happier and healthier. So it's hard to extricate laughter from the social situations that generated it. For example, if there's more laughter in our life and we're healthier, is it because of the act of laughter? Or is it because we're spending more time with individuals who we like?
That's Robert Provine, who is a neuroscientist and professor of psychology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. His book is Curious Behavior, Yawning, Laughing, Hiccuping, and Beyond. Robert, very interesting. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, for centuries, Jesuits have been traveling the world to spread the Catholic faith, but one Jesuit priest has found the best way to reach people is by staying at home and using technology. Reporter John Kalish has his story.
42-year-old Father Robert Ballaser grew up in California. He built his first PC with discarded computer parts he retrieved dumpster diving at Silicon Valley tech companies.
In my family, my father was the guy who always wanted to know how everything worked. He's the one who gave me the desire to take everything apart, which he very much regretted later on because I would take everything apart.
In college, Ballaser excelled in computer science but also felt a spiritual calling, which led him to the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits.
When I started looking into the Jesuits, I realized, you know, one of the things that they believe is finding God in all things and using the skills of every one of its members. And when I realized that that's what they were looking for, I was like, okay, this is the organization I want to belong to.
Father Ballester calls himself the digital Jesuit. He's played a key role in bringing the order's West Coast division online and countered slanderous conspiracy websites that regularly denounce Jesuits. The TWIT podcast network in Northern California discovered Ballester in its chat room and hired him in 2010. Tom Merritt served as one of the TWIT hosts.
Father Robert is impressive because he is someone who can make those complicated topics very easy to understand and very relatable. It was extra impressive because he was very obviously not someone who had this as their main occupation, right? He was a priest.
On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Yahoo has a bad week and so does Cisco. Google fights for access to utility poles and everything you wanted to know about Metro Wireless.
Ballester wears a Roman collar on camera. He travels around covering the Consumer Electronics Show and Hackers Conference in Las Vegas, as well as the cell phone industry trade show in Madrid. But is this work consistent with the Jesuit mission? Father Tom Smolich, the director of the Jesuit Refugee Service, says it is.
Francis of Assisi, I think, put it well, you know, always preach the gospel. When necessary, use words. That's what Robert's doing. He's being present in the sort of digital frontier.
This is their Type-C 3.1 flash drive. They're only $23, but here's the cool thing. So on this side, it's USB 3. The other side, that's USB-C. I got myself a lot of these things.
Yeah.
Ballester uses Padre SJ as his handle in the chat room for the TWIT podcasting network. He gets regular requests to chat privately, and he says such chats are rarely about technology.
It's always someone who wants to talk about a personal issue, who wants to talk about something that's really bothering them. And I treasure those moments.
Father Ballester considers his time in the chat room and the podcast studio as part of what he calls his ministry of presence.
I firmly believe in the ability of technology to change and improve the human condition.
Some of those improvements can be minor. Ballester also co-hosts a podcast called Know How, which recently explained how to hack a soda-making machine. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
Presidents do criticize or praise industries, but it's rare for one to target an individual company. Teddy Roosevelt did it, so did John F. Kennedy, and now President-elect Donald Trump with his comments on Carrier, Ford, Boeing. And Trump has taken what many presidents have done, try to influence business leaders behind closed doors, into the public eye. NPR's Sonari Glinton has a look.
Let's begin this story by getting into the Wayback Machine. I'll set the dial for April 11th, 1962.
President Kennedy devotes the greater portion of his news conference to criticizing the major steel companies.
John Kennedy is the president. Inflation is a real worry, and U.S. Steel wants to raise the price of steel, which would effectively raise the price of everything with steel in it. Remember, it's the 60s and before plastics got really big.
United States Steel and other leading steel corporations increasing steel prices by some $6 a ton constitute a wholly unjustifiable an irresponsible defiance of the public interest.
This move was popular at the time, and Kennedy laid it on.
Some time ago, I asked each American to consider what he would do for his country, and I asked the steel company. In the last 24 hours, we had their answer.
Well, in general, presidents have been reluctant to do that.
Bruce Shulman is a presidential historian at Boston University. He says presidents don't usually want to waste their power by picking small fights.
Presidents since McKinley have been loath to involve themselves at this kind of micro level, and especially because they don't want to appear to be giving a competitive advantage to one company or another.
Shulman says these sorts of moves are popular with the general public in the short term, but over time,
chief executives of these corporations have a long memory, and they're not going to trust a president that interferes in the day-to-day aspects of their business this way.
President-elect Donald Trump has threatened Ford about moving jobs to Mexico, the same with Carrier, and last week he criticized Boeing for a $4 million contract for Air Force One that doesn't exist.
So from a persuasion standpoint, what he's doing is a masterclass.
So you're Scott Adams, and
I'm the creator of the Dilbert comic strip, and I've been writing and blogging about Donald Trump for the past year. based on my knowledge of hypnosis and persuasion technique.
Adams says Trump isn't really acting like a politician. He's acting like a CEO, and he's doing what a CEO would do in the first weeks on the job.
You want to show immediate competence in a way that everybody can understand. So if the first thing that Trump did was, let's say, something about TPP, nobody would understand what he did or why it was useful. But if you say, I'm going to Ford, I'm going to save this many jobs, everybody has a crystal clear idea of what that is. So from a persuasion standpoint, that is just perfection. From a how many jobs did you save and did it really make a difference to the country? Well, not much. But as a message, it's extraordinary.
Julia Zari is professor of political science at Marquette University in Milwaukee. She says it can help a CEO to act unpredictably, especially when negotiating. But she says presidents usually worry about instability.
You can't really know what's going on. You can't really understand the other person's motivations. And I think that's something that we ought to take really seriously.
The other thing Azari says is, what happens when the plant closes in your town and the president is too busy? Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
President Obama's term is drawing to a close, which is provoking competing headlines. Here's one from the Boston Globe. For Ethel Rosenberg, a presidential pardon. Here's Tablet Magazine. Ethel Rosenberg should not be pardoned. Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were convicted of spying for the Soviet Union and executed in 1953. In 1995, newly released Soviet documents revealed that Julius was definitely a spy, but the Soviets indicated Ethel knew he was, but wasn't a spy herself. Then in 2008, a man who served time for spying with Julius insisted Ethel was not a spy. In 2003, David Greenglass, Ethel's brother, who stole intelligence from Los Alamos for the Soviets, told 60 Minutes that during the Rosenbergs' trial, he falsely implicated his sister Ethel to save his wife, Ruth. Ethel and Julius left behind two children, Robert and Michael, now 69 and 73 years old. They're petitioning for one of the president's pardons in the last weeks of his presidency. Robert Meeropol is founder of the Rosenberg Fund for Children, which aids children of jailed activists, and he joins us from the studios of NEPR in Springfield, Massachusetts. Robert, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
This is an ongoing, very long battle for you. There is some momentum growing for a pardon for your mother. You went to the White House last week. What did you do there?
We went to the White House to reenact my brother's presentation when he was 10 and I was 6. He presented a letter to then President Eisenhower asking that our parents be saved. And this time went to the White House, the same guard kiosk, and we presented 44,000 petition signers and our own detailed request with all sorts of evidentiary background to the White House. But one thing I must say to correct an error, we're not asking for a pardon. We're asking for an exoneration. And there's a big difference. We are essentially saying that my mother's trial and conviction was a perversion of justice. And we're asking for a nullification of the verdict. You don't pardon someone who's not guilty. And the government doesn't usually pardon people posthumously. So in some ways, we have no choice but to take this other route.
Well, we've spoken before, and there has been a steady drip of evidence that your mother, Ethel Rosenberg, was wrongly sentenced to death. There were the declassified Soviet files from 1995. They had a code name for your father, Julius, talked about his involvement, no code name for Ethel in 2008. One of your father's co-defendants said he had been a spy. He admitted that. And while confirming that Julius was, said that your mother was not adamantly. But how about the opinion of Tablet Magazine, which is the opinion of many? It says even if she might have been wrongly convicted with false evidence from her brother in particular, she knew at least two KGB officers, according to those Soviet documents. She sat in on meetings. Clearly, she was not a master spy, but she was not a passive observer. They say it was wrong to execute her. But it would be wrong to exonerate her.
Well, see, here's the problem. First of all, if you read the actual files, there was no contact, direct contact between my mother and any Soviet agent. But they kind of want to fudge things. And what they really want to do is to divert attention from our central claim, which is that the trial was a perversion of justice. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that the government facilitated the invention of evidence in order to convict someone in a capital crime, that should be of a concern to absolutely everybody. And that's what we want Obama to proclaim.
Well, time is running out for you because there's an odd twist with the incoming president that might preclude any consideration of this for at least the next 4 years, maybe longer. And I'm just going to lay this out. In an odd coincidence, Roy Cohn, the lawyer, did that direct examination of Ethel's brother, David Greenglass, lying about his sister to save his wife. It produced that false testimony. Roy Cohn gloated about helping to win that verdict with that testimony. He was also the right-hand man for Senator Joe McCarthy in the communist witch hunts. Then in the 70s, he represented Donald Trump in those charges that the Trumps, Donald and his father, violated fair housing rules by not renting to blacks. Now, Cohn and Trump lost that suit. Trump had to settle out of court. But Roy Cohn was a mentor for Donald Trump. This was one of Roy Cohn's biggest achievements, that he sent Ethel Rosenberg to her death.
And that's why you're absolutely right. If this doesn't happen by January 20th, it's not going to happen during a Trump administration. In fact, Roy Cohn did even more. He actually was the one who coerced David Greenglass into inventing the testimony that sent my mother to her death. So you might say that the ghost of Ethel Rosenberg is going to haunt the Trump administration. And I do want to get one more respond to one more thing, because I don't want to appear to be dodging anything. Yes, it is true that my mother did know about my father's activities. It's hard for me to know how much she knew, but we do not convict people based upon their knowledge or their beliefs. We convict people based upon their actions.
You know, Robert, this is your main passion right now. But I just want to ask, what's it been like? It has been decades since this happened. Do you have memories of your mother?
Unfortunately, I don't really have clear memories of living with my parents. They were arrested shortly after my third birthday. And I do remember visiting them in prison. I remember talking with my mother in prison. I sort of have a sense of the sound of her voice. I remember how short she was. She was only 5 feet tall. I remember those things, and I remember a sense of dread that hung over everything that I didn't understand, but I knew had something to do with my family. It has been a very long battle. But the best thing we did was we focused on freedom of information, on the concept that our beliefs were less important than the actual truth, and to let the public see everything and decide for themselves. And as a result of that strategy, we have forced so much material into the public eye that it's finally led to this. We're using the government's own material to destroy their case.
Well, and just one last thing. You mentioned you and your brother as children trying to petition to then-President Eisenhower. You know, Eisenhower said that because of the actions of at least your father, millions of people died because of the information about weapons that was sent to the Soviet Union. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, that's part of the myth of the secret of the atomic bomb. We now know, because we forced all this material out, that even the material that David Greenglass did, which I don't think my father facilitated at all.
Your uncle was working on the Manhattan Project. Yeah,
right. Even the material that David Greenglass gave turned out to be worthless. So this whole idea, the myth that somehow my parents facilitated the Soviet Union getting their atomic bombs 1 second even before they would have anyway, is just false.
What would it mean to you to have your mother exonerated?
Well, we found out that my father did commit espionage, but realizing that my mother didn't, that she wasn't given a code name, that she wasn't a spy, this has been on my agenda ever since. And This is my mother, who was taken from me when I was 3 and killed when I was 6. I couldn't imagine anything that would make me more satisfied, and it also a deep sense of satisfaction that something that I've been trying to do for so long has finally borne fruit, and that it's not just for me, it's not just for my brother, it's for the betterment of the entire country.
Robert Meeropol, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Robert Meeropol, the son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, who were convicted of spying for the Soviet Union and executed in 1953. He and his brother are seeking a presidential exoneration for his mother. And by the way, Robert and Michael are also the adopted sons of Abel Meeropol, who was so enraged by a photo of lynching that he wrote the song Strange Fruit, recorded by Billie Holiday. Meeropol was a teacher, and like many New York teachers at the time, a communist, which to them meant fighting racism and supporting workers. He was called to testify before a hearing in which New York lawmakers grilled him on whether the American Communist Party paid him to write this song. They had.
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Some of the country's top tech leaders will be at Trump Tower in New York tomorrow to meet with the president-elect for what's expected to be a wide-ranging discussion on key issues within the tech sector, including jobs, immigration, taxes, and cybersecurity. And it should be interesting, given that Donald Trump spent part of his campaign publicly attacking those in Silicon Valley, including some by name. For a look at what to expect, let's check in with our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor of Recode. He joins us from New York. Hi, Ed.
Hi.
Well, let's start with who is attending this meeting.
So basically all the big names, Apple CEO Tim Cook, Alphabet, that's the Google's new name, its CEO Larry Page, Facebook Sheryl Sandberg, the founder of Tesla Elon Musk, IBM CEO Ginni Rometty. We also know Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos was invited, not entirely clear yet if he's going to show up, but likely he will.
Is Peter Thiel, who's been a Trump supporter, going?
Yes, in fact, he being on Trump's transition team, he helped organize it. Mm. So he's the one who sort of helped come up with the list of names.
Now, as we mentioned, Donald Trump spent the last few months going after companies like Amazon and Apple, including this moment that stands out from February when Trump attacked Apple for refusing to unlock the iPhone used by one of the San Bernardino attackers. Here was Trump.
What I think you ought to do is boycott Apple until such time as they give that security number. How do you like that? I just thought it. Boycott Apple.
Boycott Apple. So how is this meeting expected to go?
I love how he just said, I just thought of this,
right.
as he's talking. It's going to be tense, to say the least. Remember, Silicon Valley overwhelmingly supported Hillary Clinton, not just on issues like immigration and cybersecurity, but also on social issues like gay rights and women's rights. Trump has been hostile to these issues.
And what about the issue of jobs? Because Trump has talked about calling on Apple to cut manufacturing in China and start making iPhones, et cetera, in the United States.
So Trump still has this very kind of 1970s sense of the American economy, which is, say, it's driven by commodities and manufacturing. It still is, but it's shifting, right? The U.S. is turning into more of a tech and services economy, and that's a difficult transition. I mean, factory workers aren't going to just morph into tech or service jobs. But to think that Apple should be making iPhones in the U.S., it's short-sighted. Of course they could, but then you'd have to pay $2,000 for an iPhone. I mean, there's a reason why the economy sort of functions the way it does. Yes, there are certainly jobs you can sort of incentivize to keep in the U.S., but in terms of sort of growing these businesses, you know, you need to tap sort of labor forces around the world, which then begets a different kind of economy locally, right? So if we're making iPhones abroad, services and media businesses might be something that you can bolster or build up in the U.S.
What about the issue of immigration, which is another contrast between these tech leaders and the president-elect?
Silicon Valley, companies like Facebook and Apple and Google, whatnot, they are starved for engineering talent. They've had to go overseas to get it. China, India, Russia, parts of even Africa and the Middle East, believe it or not, that's where they're also going to try to find workers. The U.S. hasn't done a great job of building up sort of the STEM economy, their STEM labor force, which is, say, the science technology sector. And I think that's part of the disconnect. I think ultimately both sides do want the same thing, just to have more Americans do these jobs. That requires more education, but it also needs a sort of a better immigration policy or immigration form that allows these tech companies to meet that gap.
And on the issue of cybersecurity, following that San Bernardino attack, Trump spoke to voters and said this.
We're losing a lot of people because of the internet, and we have to do something. We have to go see Bill Gates and a lot of different people that really understand what's happening. We have to talk to them, maybe in certain areas, closing that internet up in some way. Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people. We have a lot of foolish people. We have a lot of foolish people.
What might President-elect Trump mean for cybersecurity and privacy, and what are the concerns in the tech industry about that?
So this is definitely one of the most troubling things he said, and especially for people who work in tech. I mean, he's been very vocal about the need for tech companies to comply with what he sees as imminent terror threats. Now, it's one thing to comply with court order and things like that, which is sticky enough, but he seems to want to curtail the internet itself the way that China already does. And that's troubling because a big part of the ethos that drives Silicon Valley entrepreneurs is the idea that expression should be unfettered, right? And that can be both good and bad, of course. I mean, just look at all the trolling on Twitter. But few in the Valley would react positively to the idea of censoring the internet in some way.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Ed Lee. Your colleague Kara Swisher wrote a piece for Recode yesterday criticizing these tech leaders for, quote, bowing and scraping to that Luddite Trump who will probably simultaneously berate us in person and bully us on Twitter later. Just explain that sentiment in the few seconds we have left.
Well, I mean, I think she wants to hold them up to a higher standard. You know, you have an opportunity. You need to press him. You need to sort of make these issues clear and not bow down and not sort of relent in any kind of way. And speak out publicly. I think that's really what she's asking them to do. And we have yet to fully see that.
That's Ed Lee, managing editor of Recode. And of course, we will be watching as the tech leaders head to Trump Tower in New York tomorrow for their meeting with the president-elect. Ed, thanks so much.
Sure, anytime.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.